Welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast for September 2017. I'm your host, Jonathan Butrin, and I'm joined once again by the bearded genius, Tim Nelson. Tim said he's got the Kevin Smith look going on.
I've got a beard and long hair. I need a trench coat and a silent J.
Backwards hat. Yeah.
Smoochie boochies.
How you doing, Tim?
I'm all right.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You hanging in there, man?
Oh, yeah. I'm having some coffee, talking about film. Yep. Can't really beat that.
It's hot again.
Which is weird for us. We're not used to that around here. Mm-hmm. Once it hits September, it's supposed to be shivering, cold, miserable weather.
It's almost going to be October, and it's like 90 degrees outside. That's not fun, but it's okay.
Yeah, global warming. I believe in it. I don't know about you.
No comment.
We're going to get in trouble.
We don't want to get political again.
Oh, it's apparently science is political for you.
Yeah, apparently everything's political. That's the problem with this world. Okay, so here we go. I just got back from Minnesota, Tim. I attended a conference out there.
Okay.
CrossVision is what it was called. It was basically, you know Greg Boyd?
Yeah, sure.
One of my favorite theologians of all time. And there was a book he wrote called The Crucifixion of the Warrior God, like 1,500-page opus about one of my most like pressing topics. What do we do with Old Testament violence in light of Jesus? And so he's written this huge book about it. It was fascinating. And so this conference kind of delved into in depth about that. Rachel Held Evans was there and Bruxy Cavey was there. And it was so good, man. It was just so refreshing. So I just got back from that yesterday.
Do we not have to read the Old Testament anymore?
No, it is not. He is not an advocate of the dismissal solution, as it's referred to, where you just kind of chuck it out. He actually has a way where we continue to believe the text is God-breathed and necessary for our lives, and yet he finds a way to...
So I still have to read the Old Testament?
You still have to read it. Oh, you have to read it through the lens of the cross. Yes, it's wonderful. So everyone check out that book, and it was just a great conference. So it's on my mind because I just got back yesterday afternoon. I was there for like 4 days. It was beautiful.
That's cool.
Yes. All right. Well, here we go. We should probably talk about movies. I guess that's the point. So we've lamented on the last few shows, Tim Nelson, about how sad 2017 has been.
It's awful. Like, people are going to lose their jobs because the movies are so bad. I'm serious. Have you read any of these articles?
It's tough. It's been
a
rough year.
It's basically saying, like, these theaters now have to close. And, like, it's horrible. Guys, all we needed was a few good movies that weren't, like, you know, Wolverine 4 or whatever. You know, whatever's out right now.
Right.
We just needed some good movies, and apparently we did not deliver. There's a couple. But not like a normal summer.
There's been a few, but it's not been, especially in light of last year, which I know I always say, but it just feels like this is the rebound year. So it's been rough, but I'm starting to feel hopeful. I really feel like maybe we've turned a corner. We're entering into the heart of the film season, September through the end of the year. This is where the magic happens, right? Because I, for one, am encouraged by the film we're going to be talking about today, and we literally have not talked about it in person. We're trying something new. We didn't have any discussions about the film before, and so I don't even know Tim Nelson's opinion, but I, for one, was encouraged by this film because I enjoyed it way better than I thought I was going to. So, Tim, what movie are we reviewing today?
We are reviewing It.
It. Yes. We are reviewing the
Volume 1. Chapter 1.
Yes.
Chapter 1.
The September juggernaut, It. This film has made so much money. This is like New Line Cinema is back in business. What I remember about New Line Cinema is Lord of the Rings. You know, they were...
I was going to say, are we going to... Now with all this income, are we going to be forced to sit through more Hobbit movies? Or
it might. They might bring back another trilogy with, like, you know, just the Silmarillion. Let's just get into the weeds. But anyway, New Line Cinema is back in action. I mean, I haven't checked. I checked the total like 4 or 5 days ago, and it was like 250 plus million domestically.
And that's like,
I mean,
on a like $50 million budget or something.
Yeah, very low budget, and it's up there as far as R-rated horror movies. It is high on the list. So yeah, because of that, the good thing is a good chunk of our listeners have probably seen the movie. If it's made that much money, most people have probably seen it.
So what I read, and this is probably dated even at this point, was that it was the second highest horror movie domestically as far as how much money it brought in
mm-hmm.
in the month of September.
Really?
Which, if you think about that, September is when all of the pre-Halloween movies get released.
Yes.
And so there's some that are in October, but most of them, like, they want to give them a little bit of room to get into that pre-Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's pretty significant when you think about that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. New Saw movies coming out at the end of the month. So, yeah, Halloween movies are starting to roll out.
Oh,
but
no.
It. Yeah. So, yeah, go New Line Cinema. So we saw it. We both have seen the film. When did you see it, Tim?
I saw it last night.
Last night.
7:50, which apparently in my theater is 8:20.
Okay.
So if you ever go to the Mayfair,
uh-huh.
You know, your local listener.
Yeah.
If you get there on time, they'll torture you with like 50 previews of something. Some of you like that.
But, yeah, sure. You know. Well, what was your experience like? Did you go alone, I take it?
I went alone, which made me a little nervous.
Right.
I like to go to like horror movies with other people because they can be really freaky, especially if they do those like the jump scares and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, ah. But yeah, I went by myself. And
Theater?
No, it wasn't because it was Sunday night.
Okay.
But what I was surprised by is they were showing it like every half hour or something. Not maybe every half hour, but maybe like every 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And you like we had people in the theater on a Sunday night late, you know, pretty late. 8 o'clock on a Sunday is pretty late for most folks.
Mm-hmm.
And people were there and it kept filling more and more people. And I was really surprised. So,
yeah. And it's been out for almost 3-4 weeks, something like that. So, yeah.
Yeah. So it's bringing money in.
Mm-hmm. Consistently. Yep. Well, I also saw it alone, it's usually how I see movies, so it doesn't really bother me that much. But I must say that it did get under my skin after the show, which is a sign of a good horror movie. I walked out of there, and like I wasn't super scared during the movie, and we'll get more into that. But it left an impression because I saw it really late. It was like a 10:30 show, and so I'm out at like 12:31, and the cleaning crew's out there. So I go to the bathroom after the movie, and I come out, and there's this lady just like there, and I literally jumped, and feel sorry for her.
Oh,
but yeah, so it definitely accomplishes a scary tone and gets under your skin. But let's get back up to, before we get all into that, I want to start our discussion on it by talking about Stephen King. So all my life, Stephen King has gotten a really bad rap, all right? So granted, I grew up in kind of more of a conservative bubble than some people, you know, kind of a Baptist-y church in the suburbs. But so horror was like it looked down on anyway, but like there was just this special bias against Stephen King, like stay away, don't read his books, he's evil, he's got an evil agenda, he wants to corrupt your mind. So I didn't like actually read a Stephen King book until I want to say like 2 years after college is when I finally cracked my first one. And I was surprised to discover that like A, he's a really good writer, and B, there is a lot of biblical truth in his stories. Like his stories have a very moral center. Every single one I read had it. And I haven't read like a ton of his books. I've read about 6 or 7, but I was surprised by that. I mean, if you're talking, The Stand was my favorite book of his, probably one of my favorite books of all time. And not only is it a classic, but it is like apocalyptic literature as seen through the Bible. It's incredible. I was really surprised by how overt his moral center is. Tim, what's your experience with Stephen King? Have you read anything?
So I've mostly watched Stephen King movies. Okay. I think I had I don't have this view anymore, but I think I had the view that you're talking about. Actually, I have like a different view than what you're talking about. It wasn't avoid him because this is like evil. It wasn't reactionary in that sense. I think the circles that I was in is like, because I have parents that were fairly well-read at that time. I think Stephen King was very pedestrian to them. And so it was like, oh, this is pop, and you should avoid this because it's pop, which apparently a lot of people feel that way about King.
I saw John Cusack on a talk show once, and he was saying he thinks a lot of the reason why there's that pushback, because he mentioned the same thing, was that instead of like, you know, he uses pop culture references. He's not afraid to do that, right? So instead of like saying the person put laundry detergent in, he put Tide in there. You know, he's not afraid to just say that, which maybe turns people off and makes them think it's just mainstream garbage. But yeah.
Yeah, I know that there's that response. I think he's a very blue-collar writer in some ways. Not saying that he's not a skilled writer, but just in his subject matter, he's not, I always think of, he's not writing about Holden Caulfield. He's he's writing about a lot of times small town
yeah.
Maine life, right? And so that's very blue collar. Reminds me in some ways he's not like some of the generation before him, so like Steinbeck or Hemingway or anything. Like he's definitely more a writer of the people, and he writes. He's just prolific.
Oh, yeah.
And so, So I actually like him. I feel like he uses his imagination well. Mm-hmm. So he's a good storyteller, and that's just clear.
Yes.
And
a truly good writer. I really believe that. Yeah.
I do agree with the moral center part. Like he's trying to get us at some. He's not taking horror for like cheap thrills,
exactly.
or to be super grotesque. He's trying to get at some kind of truth in this genre.
Yep.
And so he himself is like, well, I hope I elevated the horror genre.
Yes.
Of novels.
Yes.
And I mean that's like his hope because he thinks that people look down on the genre, not just him. Mm. Which I think that's probably true.
I might even say, like, you know, my first brush with horror was Goosebumps growing up. R.L. Stein, you know, did you ever get into any of those?
My kid likes he's starting to read the books, and he really digs the TV show or whatever, the Canadian TV show.
Right.
Sorry. Like, stop saying that, child.
But I even think R.L. Stein, like, I mean, basically, there's your typical sort of, from a children's perspective, just kind of exploiting the genre. Like, every chapter ends with, and then he put the gun in my face and pulled the trigger. And then the next chapter, it was a squirt gun. And, you know, I mean, like, the whole book is just cheap, schlocky horror, which is fun when you're 13. But I feel like King is after something so much bigger, some of the deeper questions of life. Yeah.
He writes enough where he accomplishes that sometimes. Like, mm-hmm. sometimes in his novels, he doesn't accomplish that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think other times, you're like, oh, my gosh, this is like a study in our humanity, which I feel like the same way about... I feel like that about it.
Yes. So he's actually claimed to be a Christian in the past, by the way.
He's a theist. I know that.
A theist.
Yeah,
okay.
So he believes there is a God.
Yes. He even believes in intelligent design and says that you'd be pretty stupid not to, which is a bold statement. That was of like 2013 anyway. It was an interview I read.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, it shines through in the way he forms his characters, in the way that he treats good and evil seriously, the way that good often overcomes evil. And so, yeah, no matter what, I mean, I think the work speaks for itself. Hmm. But one book I haven't read was It. I never actually got around to it. I mean, it's just like a seminal work, but I never actually read the dang thing. The problem is like I can be kind of obsessive when I start a task. So what I did was I looked up all his books in chronological order and I was going to read all of them. And so I like started at the beginning and I got lost, you know, like seven in, and then I stopped because it's
so what you're saying is you can't read as fast as this man can write.
Well, yeah, he's got way too many books. And then when you read like seven horror books in a row, you start to be like, you know, I should read something else.
Yeah, I'm getting a little weird. Yeah, no, I get that makes sense.
Yeah.
Getting a little dark there.
And I also hadn't seen the original film, which I feel terrible about. I still haven't seen it. Did you see the original?
So I saw it, but I was like a teenager.
Okay.
And so I just remember it being that Pennywise was terrifying.
Yes.
And that's basically what I remember about the film was Pennywise.
I was going to watch it for this podcast because we're all about research here. We all always want to be prepared for our listeners. But the problem is that I was all set up to watch it after this movie, but I liked this movie so much, and I suddenly realized at the end that this is only half the story. They actually only did half of King's book, which is like 1,000 pages long. Whereas the original It movie, which was like a 4-hour miniseries, that was the whole story. And so now I'm like super invested in the story and these characters, and I want to see it play out. I don't even want to know how it ends. I don't want to know how they defeat the guy. I just want to see it play. So I purposely did not watch the original and I'm in it. So sorry, dear listeners. I don't know how it compares. And Tim, it was a long time ago. So
I never read the book.
Yeah.
So like we could have... I don't know if, and I would assume because it's such a huge book and not, I mean, it cannot translate directly.
Yeah.
So I'm just assuming that everybody's going to love the book and hate the way that some of the film interprets things or glosses over it or doesn't give any backstory on things.
Right.
But I would, I can only speak to the film that I saw recently. So I can talk about that experience of this film.
Right.
Different director, different writers or adapters or whatever, screenplay writers, I guess.
But the general consensus of the original is that it's scary. I mean, most people have
it's scary. I can confirm that.
Okay. Even in 1990, Tim remembers it was scary. I just talked to a girl when I was on this conference trip with, and she said she doesn't want to see the new one because she's traumatized because her babysitter let her see the original when she was really young, and she still has nightmares about it. So apparently it's scary, and we'll leave it at that. So, all right, for those of you out there, my mom, who has no idea what It is and has no idea what we're talking about, let me just give a little synopsis for our listeners. It is a movie about a rural town named Derry. Now, is this in Maine, do you think? I know he says most of his stories. Yeah, I know. It's okay.
No, it's in Maine.
It's in Maine. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I don't know if it's a fictional town.
It might be two towns, and one of them's in Massachusetts, and the other's in Connecticut. Whatever happened last
right,
time.
Right,
right.
Manchester?
Yeah, Manchester. Yeah.
That was funny because you looked it up on your phone, and you're like, wait a minute. All right, so they're in this town called Derry, and people are going missing. Like, the missing persons list is off the charts. Adults, but especially kids. Kids just go missing in this town all the time. And the story that the remake is concerned with involves like a specific group of these kids in Derry. They're kind of the misfits of the town. These are kids that get bullied all the time. They've got
losers.
Losers.
They're losers.
Officially, they form a club called the Losers Club. Right. They're kids that they've got family issues. They're just like their bond is that they're losers, that they're outsiders. And these kids, on top of their real life, which is in shambles, which could really be a whole movie on its own, they're being haunted by this creepy clown named Pennywise who keeps showing up in their houses or at work or whenever they least expect it. And this clown can basically take any form depending on what you're scared of. It feeds off your fear and it takes the form of your fears. But it's like primary form is a clown called Pennywise, the dancing clown. And these kids have to work together to defeat this thing, this creature that can just be anywhere and is stalking them and is wreaking havoc all over town and killing children. And that's the plot of It. That's scary. That's not cool. When I was watching, I'm like, how are these kids not in like a catatonic state? If you know that you can go home at any moment, and there's a killer clown that can take the form of your worst fears. I mean, you feel like you'd just be in a puddle of your sweat. But it's almost as if their lives are already so horrific, just the reality of it, like with the bullies and the family issues, that it's almost like they're already numbed out a little bit to pain, maybe. I don't know.
So do we want to get into like biographical stuff with King or any of that?
Biographical? Yeah, go for it.
So this is what I read, was basically his dad left when he was two, something like that, and left the family and left the mom with all these bills. And basically he had to grow up without a dad. And then King's own background is like during this period before he wrote this book, and maybe even during it, he was struggling with some pretty severe addiction issues with alcohol and cocaine. And so there's these like things, whatever. And I think that there are, that you see this in his life, that these things that are defining moments to where you can where something in your past is traumatic or painful or whatever can. And he also saw somebody die, like get hit by a train and die
when he was a kid.
One of his buddies. Yeah.
Okay.
So there's these defining moments in your life that basically place this trauma on you that you're going to have to fight. And so, like, that's reality, right? That's not even getting into the story. This is just his life.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's doing battle even at this, like, during the writing of this probably.
Yeah.
With this addiction that probably comes out of pain, this pain. So it's, like, trying to destroy him. So it's, like, really interesting psychologically to look at, like, why is he, like, writing this therapeutically? Is he, like, what's going on? And then he tends to, like, with all these books, he tends to deal with adolescents.
Yeah.
It's, like, people who are on the cusp of adulthood. And I think that's really because that's where you see all this stuff. So it's very stark, and you have a child's reaction to a very adult thing.
I didn't know that backdrop. That's really cool.
Yeah.
I can identify a lot with that. Well, let's talk about like the directing. So the film is directed by this guy named Andy Muschietti, which I had not heard of him. He is a pretty new director. His main claim to fame seems to be this movie called Mama from like 2013.
I haven't seen Mama. Like, it's supposed to be really scary.
I heard that, yeah.
I figured you had seen it.
I hadn't.
Oh,
no.
Man.
I know. Another lack of...
We have failed tonight. That's okay. So we would recommend it, but it sounds freaking crazy terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. It's got Jessica Chastain, too. I mean, that's legit.
So we can't like... We can't recommend it unless we see it. No. So we're gonna let that be.
Sorry.
You guys can do your research. There's other Christian websites for that kind of stuff.
That's right. Focus on the Family does tons of research.
I'm sure they'll love it. They'll love it.
They love
it. Family, it's really family-centered. It's called Mama.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Good old-fashioned tale.
Oh, my gosh. They did not like Mother, by the way. Plugged In Online, Focused on the Family.
I don't ever check that. I'm more upset like that you check that.
I don't.
I'm more upset. I really am.
Our social media guru, Dan Baker... maybe he checks it. I don't know. Somehow he stumbled upon it and he posted a review.
Focused on the Family.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not either one of us.
He's focused on the Family. Yeah. No, they really did not like that film. Anyway.
Huh.
There you go.
So anyway, you're saying that so
the directing.
But he didn't direct it initially. Wasn't it Fukunaga that did it?
What?
Yes.
I didn't know this.
The director changed. Yeah, and he helped write the script.
Okay.
So the director and I couldn't find this online. I was looking for it. I could not find it. I mean,
yeah, I've never heard of it.
You know, I'd love to have direct contact with these folks, but I'm not that guy.
Someday, Tim.
Hey, yeah, I'm wondering what happened here.
Yeah, we'll just call him up. Yeah.
Yeah, so basically, somehow this movie shifted hands.
Okay.
So he wasn't the original director. There was three writers, and one of them was going to direct. And he's directed a bunch of stuff, the original guy, including, like, you remember Beasts of No Nation on Netflix that got an,
yes.
I think it won an Academy Award.
Yeah, that was, like, the Netflix's first original film, and it did win an Academy Award, yeah.
So he directed that.
Okay.
So he was set to direct it. And then I guess he got somehow something happened, but I don't know what it is. I don't know what happened. Uh-huh. And so now he's credited with the writing, but nothing else.
That's really interesting. I wish I could see his version now. Like the dude who did Beasts of No Nation, like that. He probably had a totally different take from a directing standpoint.
Yeah, I'm not sure. And how much of it, like how much of his... I don't know. We got to find out what happened. If you're listening right now and you know what happened here and we just couldn't find it and you found it, would you put something on the website?
Please. No, just email us. Podcast at cinemafaith.com. Yeah.
We'd love to know and we'll read it out loud in the beginning of the next one.
We absolutely will.
But we'd like to find out what happened there because it was very mysterious.
Yes.
Brian Cooper's going to know. I just feel like it. Do you feel like he
knows? I hope Brian Cooper comes through for us. You know where to email us, Brian. So listen, I was actually, though, thankfully, pleasantly surprised at the directing because here's one of the primary virtues, I think, of this remake. And it's something that can hamper a lot of movies. This movie's almost 2.5 hours long. And for a horror movie, I mean, that could be like the death rattle, right? But the length of this movie is actually, I think, the best thing it has going for it because Muschietti takes his time establishing all of these characters and establishing the tone and the setting of this place. Like, it just, the movie has a really strong sense of place, which was what elevates it past just being this creepy genre film about a creepy clown. Like, we feel like we're a part of the town and we feel connected to every character so that we would really feel it if any one of these characters went down.
Yeah.
You agree with that?
Yeah. It feels, this is what we were talking about slightly before the podcast, and we talked very briefly. This is one thing we agreed on. It feels like Stand By Me, the Rob Reiner,
yes.
Stephen King. And in fact, that's the one King likes the best of all the adaptations.
Of course.
But it has a feel because in that movie, you get to know the characters. You get to know like their the brokenness in their life, their flaws, all those kind of things. So this takes on that. It almost has like a Breakfast Club-y feel.
Yeah.
You know?
They even reference that one girl from the Breakfast Club.
Molly Ringwald.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Because she kind of looks like Molly Ringwald.
Like her. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll see what happens there. But So I think that there's this kind of, you have to do that if you're going to have such a large cast. And then they have to do that for the novel. And the structure becomes actually pretty simple as far as the movie goes. Mm-hmm. It's like you've got if you consider the town as a character.
Which it is. It feels like it.
And then, the town and then the parents. So, like, the idea that, like, all these kids would go and the parents are in denial.
Yes, every one of them.
So that, and there's like no adults in that film who are like
with
they're
it.
All, yeah, yeah. It's like there's no adults to help.
Yeah,
and so they're all the adults are all like just in denial.
They're either absent or perverted or messed up. Yeah, right.
So like every adult is danger.
Yeah, yeah.
Or yeah, either danger or aloof. Mm-hmm. And so it's really like, you know, it's like watching Charlie Brown.
Yeah.
Except there's a killer clown running around. The killer
clown. Slightly different tone.
Hey, Linus.
Nice.
Yeah. So, yeah.
And it was also a really well shot movie. Like, I feel like I want to use the word like crisp, right? Just everything, the whole package, kind of makeup, wardrobe, effects, props, just everything is really smooth. And maybe some people might like find that as a criticism that it was too glossy, but I actually think it worked really well. Like, it just felt well designed, the whole thing.
It had good like visual motif.
Yes.
So like the river and the pipes and just all these and blood and all these things that were within the novel, I'm sure.
And the colors too. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so you have that, like, it's all woven in.
Yeah.
And so you don't, it's not like taking over, but they've, and a lot of the shots are really, the contrast between like a very beautiful natural shots, like a shot of that river, right?
Yeah.
And then immediately you're like in some hell
bathroom. Right.
Right. So like right next to each other, that juxtaposition to me is like, it makes it a very strong visuals.
Mm-hmm.
And so that you feel peaceful and then jarred and peaceful and then jarred and peaceful and jarred. And I think it kind of keeps the pace right, the visual pace right.
Yes. And the pacing is right in general. There's really no part that drags super heavy. There's some repetition here and there, which is one of the flaws. But overall, I think it does not feel like a 2.5-hour movie. It feels perfect as far as pacing. Well, how about acting, man? Okay, kid actors. Like, where are they finding all these kid actors?
Oh, no, they're all rocking.
Unbelievable.
Like, every single one of those actors.
Everyone.
They're just fantastic.
I mean, kid actors can tank a movie, right? If you get that kid that, like, is overdoing it or
Phantom
whatever.
Phantom Menace?
I mean, oh, yes.
Sorry, that's probably
that
too
was,
easy.
That's wrong for so many reasons.
I understand.
But, yeah. But, yeah, I mean, I watched a clip of there was something on YouTube that was juxtaposing the opening scene of the remake with the opening scene of the first of the movie from 1990,
yeah.
And the kid from 1990 was overacting, and it was jarring to me. I don't know if he keeps that up in the whole. Well, he wouldn't, that's just an example of like it just immediately takes you out of it. And these kids are natural actors.
Yeah, they're good actors, and then they also say one of the things I really hate about kid movies that writers that write kid language and kid dialogue, and it doesn't sound like a kid.
Yeah,
so they tend to me it's like you tend to over. You like a real 13-year-old, 12-year-old kid is going to be cussing. They're going to be saying dirty, just horrible, dirty jokes.
Right.
Some of the kids will respond, some won't. I think that King has done a good job at like creating characters that can be embodied by actors.
Mm.
And so I think that's true. You see that throughout all his movies when there's kids in those movies. But yeah, I see what you're saying. Like it can be overdone.
Yeah.
I also like the quiet brooding. I mean, that's just kind of like a technique, but like the River Phoenix look-alike kid that's like the protagonist here. It's like the quiet brooding kid that is the leader.
Yeah, I forget his name, but yeah, I know what you're talking about. He's like the main kid whose little brother is missing, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep, he was great. There is the guy from Stranger Things who plays Mike Wheeler.
He is so funny.
Good.
Like,
yeah.
There are comedy movies that do not like didn't make me laugh as much as this kid's horrible dirty jokes.
And lame jokes.
They're so bad that they're just hilarious.
It's like what you're saying where half the kids are giggling and half the kids are like, you're an idiot. It's so perfectly captured.
That's like real life.
Right.
Like that's kids.
Right.
They're like, seriously? And the other half's like And I even love that scene where he's like he's playing that guy. He's like in the band in a parade and he's like screwing around trying to play his sousaphone or whatever. And he's just like bothering the kid. He's like, knock it off. Give me it back. It's like so authentic.
It is. And Stranger Things is so good. By the way, Netflix, you know, is one of our sponsors. So we have to plug Stranger Things season one.
That is not true.
Watch it now. And season two coming in October. Yeah, so he's great, and I like the girl, too. Her name is Sophia Lillis. She plays Beverly in the movie. I think her performance of all of them stuck out to me. It's probably because she's the oldest of the bunch, but I don't know. There was a lot of subtlety and depth in her performance. It was great.
Yeah, I was impressed with her. She was, because she's only 15.
15, okay.
And she was able to... that's a complicated role that she had.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking. Right.
And was able to play the role of someone. I mean, like, first off, the role of like someone who's been abused like that. Yep. That's complicated, right? Yep. And then also she has to still be open. She's like still a loving person and open to people, but also like there's dark moments. So I feel like I don't know how she did that. And then she's also able to... and this is, I don't know how young actresses do this, but also like you need in that role, you need to have, she has to basically show sexuality in that role. Uh-huh. And this is something like people don't want to talk about, but like, I think you see this in some of the, because she has to project that because it has to be believable enough that these boys would actually like, that would be like part of like, they'd be drawn to it. So she's able to do that in a way that's not, like exploiting her,
right?
But where you're like, oh yeah, this is believable,
right? Like that scene when they're in the river and she's laying down with her glasses on, and all the boys are just staring at her with their mouth open,
like kind of amazed, like she's like a natural phenomenon or something.
Yeah.
So she has to be able to kind of pull that off, and I think that's like super difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I don't know how she was able to do all of those things. So like, and all that range.
Yeah.
And then also like be. Yeah, and then kind of a strong, she's kind of a protagonist too. I mean, mm-hmm. she's strength in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
So she has to also be like be a hero too, or a heroine.
Yes.
And so I was really impressed with her.
I really was too. You're right. It's every emotion you could possibly convey. At the end of the day, when most horror movies, all you're asking your actress to do is just run away screaming, right? But there was so much more required here, and all of the actors stepped up to the plate and knocked it out. Yeah, really great.
Yeah, I think I like her the complexity, because the temptation of that character would be, and maybe this could be coached. I don't know what her process is, especially when you're 15,
mm-hmm.
but. The temptation is to play a victim in that role, which which would make sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
But she's able to play that role quite differently.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Someone that's kind of just being bounced around from one horrible thing to the other, but she exudes this strength.
And she survives.
Yeah.
Like, she's a survivor, so, like, encountering Pennywise is, like, daily. It's like, I can deal with this.
Yeah, you know what right.
I mean? She's like, I deal with worse stuff at my own house.
Have you seen my dad?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So it's like she's able to have that strength. So the person that is, you know, everybody's suffering in that group of kids, but she's able to really overcome that in a way that's interesting. So she becomes a leader out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Not overcome it, but she uses that pain to do something.
Absolutely. But we'd be remiss to not mention the heart of the movie, which is, of course, Pennywise the Clown, played by Bill Skarsgård. Do you have any experience with Bill Skarsgård?
I should, because he's in a bunch of movies.
He is.
Tell me what he's in.
I watched a terrible show on Netflix called Hemlock Grove, which was like their first foray into horror. Terrible show. Do not watch it. Can say that because Netflix is not our sponsor. It's terrible. It's a total waste of time. But Bill Skarsgård was like the lead of that show. He played this kind of quasi vampire guy, and so I'm familiar with him from that. But I really think he nails Pennywise, and I know this is like a role that some people wouldn't consider a performance because he's just the villain, but it really does take a certain personality and almost a charm and also a malevolence that you have to nail this kind of dance. And I think he's great in this role, and he has to be. What did you think, Bill Skarsgård?
It's hard. It's a hard role.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if I feel like he's more... Because there's so much CGI that goes into Pennywise the Clown.
Now, that's a common complaint, but I mean... I understood that there was, but is it really noticeable? Is it the kind of CGI that you're like, oh, that's CGI? I mean, like, it flows like naturally.
Eating, well, like when he's eating people's faces. Well,
yeah, I get it, but it's not like, if you didn't know what CGI was and you were just found this movie at a desert, you would just see that, you would, yeah. Right? You know what I'm
saying?
Well,
one of the reviews I read was that he gets less scary every time we see him.
Yeah, this is fair.
And I think that's true. I think he's the scariest when he's...
The opening scene.
When he's benevolent.
Mm-hmm.
He's
mm-hmm.
terrifying when he's benevolent.
Yes. Because, I completely agree with that.
And I think that as soon as he goes, like, evil, he's not that scary anymore.
Yeah, it's true. The best scene is probably the opening scene with him, because so you've got this little kid and it's raining and the mood is so perfect with, like, you know what part of that scene that keeps sticking out to me? I don't know why. Sometimes the most random stuff sticks out to me is when the little kid is walking outside with his boat and his mom is playing the piano in the rain, and it's just like, that's been the music mm-hmm. so far,
the
and
yeah.
then you see that's just a really nice subtle touch that
yeah.
that really stands out. But anyway, he goes outside and he's doing his sailboat in the rain and it falls down the gutter, and there in the gutter is Pennywise, and he starts out so disarmingly charming, even though he obviously looks creepy and the kid is scared at first, but he actually gets this kid to the point where he trusts him. And because he's just kind of got this goofy voice, and he's like, do you like the circus? And popcorn, pop, pop, pop. And, you know, the kid starts laughing or whatever. But then this is the creepiest part, is when he gets him laughing, it's almost like suddenly Pennywise snaps out of the charm and he just looks at the kid and starts growling. Just like, you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
That was the creepiest thing to me. And that's when the kid obviously is like, okay, time to go, and everything turns south.
So what's scary about clowns is, like, they're supposed to be like, make you laugh
uh-huh.
or make you have joy, but they're so, and they're anthropomorphic, right? So they look like people.
Mm-hmm.
But something's slightly off.
Yeah.
And so I think, like, that's what makes clowns scary in the first place. And then when a clown is pushing that they're like, you know, come on, be my friend, or come closer to me, I'm trustworthy.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
when they're terrifying.
Yeah.
When it becomes like, I'm just a creature, like, then it could be anything at that
mm-hmm.
point.
Mm-hmm.
And then Pennywise loses. So I think the idea of him getting the trust of kids is, like, totally freaky.
Yes.
But I think it's hard because he very quickly kind of morphs into you're kind of more jump scares.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just like, boom.
Yeah.
There's Pennywise's face.
Yeah.
Boom. There he is. Or then they do some CGI where he, like, unwraps himself from a refrigerator.
And like that. Again,
yeah.
It's not CGI that's like, oh, that's CGI. I think it's smooth and it works.
I think the scariest scene of the movie, he's not even in it. Like, to me, the scariest scene is when the Jewish kid is in the office.
Yeah.
And he drops it. I don't want to wreck
Wait,
it.
Wait, you
so
mean the
freaking scary.
The library?
The library. He's his dad's office. He's a rabbi.
Oh, I'm sorry. You mean the Jewish kid with
the library
picture.
Scene scary
the library
too,
scene
but that
scene
wasn't
scary.
That gave me more chills with the that one.
Yeah.
So when he's in that office, I don't want to wreck it for people because
yep.
it's so fun.
Yep. Yeah, it is. It is. It is.
But that was way. And the library scene was scarier than Pennywise.
Yeah, I like that.
I mean, he's. I guess he's in it, but like those two scenes were way more scary. Like, the ideas behind those scenes are way mm-hmm. way scarier.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the first scene with Pennywise, and then I think it's downhill from there. I agree with that reviewer. I can't remember who it was.
Yeah, and people have argued that he kind of turns cartoonish towards the end, but I don't know. I'll land on a soft opposite side of that debate. I think it works. I think you're right that he's most effective at the beginning, and but I think it's a consistent performance that kind of dances between that line of being sadistic and also charming, and I like it. And just the iconic imagery of, like, you know, him just being in an open field in broad daylight with, like, a red balloon that slowly drifts up, and he's just kind of, like, got that drooping face. I just think,
right, because it's, yeah, like, trust, he wants you to trust him, and he's inherently untrustworthy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think he kind of mirrors, like, this. I mean, so he's like the adult that wants you to trust him, but you can't.
Mm.
And you, like, deeply know that. Like, you just really know you can't trust this clown.
Yeah, yeah.
Something's not right.
So, Tim, let me ask you a question. Would you say that it is scary?
So, I was thinking about this.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say there are scenes that are scary, but they're using some classic technique to make them scary.
Yeah.
What I would say is it's more magical realism. which is like, you know, well, that's a, I'm taking, stealing that term. I'm appropriating it from like Latin American genres.
Can you define it?
It's like there's realistic things that have magical things occur, like kind of jump into those realistic things.
Okay.
So that's probably a very crappy definition of magical realism, but it's found like a lot, like Pan's Labyrinth.
I was just going to say
that.
So that
would be considered like magical realism. But from this standpoint, like I look at this in similar way, it just happens to be much darker than most of magical realism is. Mm-hmm. So the idea of, So I would put it in that category, which leads you more into like contemplation to some degree, and fascination,
mm-hmm.
and you're a little bit, you get taken with it,
yeah.
more than you get terrified by it, but you get, you're like, well, I wonder what this place is really like. It just draws you in.
You're sucked in the whole time.
Yeah, yeah,
and you want to see what happens next. Yeah.
Right. So I like, I look at it as being, and I think King has this in several, like Green Miles this way. A lot of them are this way. And so for me, like, I like that. Like I like there being, okay, this is how life seems. And then, but just right below this is something that is this metaphysical craziness.
Right? Yes.
Or something
fascinating,
or that there's a war right below the surface.
I love The Green Mile, by the way.
Yeah.
I just saw that the other day. Again, so good. You got John Coffey, which is such a obvious reference to JC, and it's just a beautiful movie. It's horror, it's comedy, you laugh, you cry. It's a great film. Tom Hanks with a bladder infection. Anyway.
There's a mouse.
The mouse. All the mouse. I think you're dead on, is that it's more of a fascination and instead of true terror, but it does get under your skin. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it gets under your skin because it's a reflection. He uses these magical situations to be reflections of reality. So things that we don't talk about. So the idea that a whole town would ignore the well-being of the kids.
Yeah.
That's something that like sounds autobiographical to me. It's like basically the primary adult in his life left. Just straight up left him.
Mm.
And then that who would you go to? Well, it's not going to be another adult. It's going to have to be a group of kids. Like that is true for so many kids.
Yeah.
So it was like, it's so true, even though it's so false. Like there's no clown, you know, that's trying to kill kids out there.
Mm-hmm.
But are kids like dealing with these same traumas?
Right.
Absolutely. And are they responding? Is it self-destructive? Like if they don't, you know, band together, are they going to be destroyed? Yeah. I don't know. It was funny because I was thinking of it like I have a lot of experience in recovery and recovery groups.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it was like by the end of the movie, I was like, these kids are like their own recovery group.
Hmm.
And they're like, well, the way it kills kids is it isolates them.
Yep. That's right.
And then it takes advantage of their trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And then it destroys them. And then they kind of like get lifeless and float.
Right? Yes, right.
It takes their life out of their eyes.
Huh.
And so to me, like the idea that they would come together so that they could fight something that is really, that's real in their lives. And each one of the characters has like a significant trauma. I don't know if we've talked about that yet.
We haven't. Every one of them. I mean, you've got the, one of them, dad is molesting her. That's the girl performance we were talking about. You have one of the kids, like his mom's a hypochondriac and is feeding him placebo pills. Another kid's getting relentlessly bullied to the point of like carving things in his stomach. I mean, this isn't just like normal bullying. I mean, just everyone. You can go down the list. Yeah, it's terrible. And I agree. And even if you can't relate to that whole, obviously we can't really relate to a clown terrorizing us, but I think we can all, and maybe it's just me, but we can all relate to that kind of time when you're young where you feel like you can't fully trust your parents with some of the deepest things that you're carrying. And all you've got is your friends, and you have to figure it out. And it's not a clown, but at that moment, you know, whatever it is that's swirling around your brain feels just about as heavy. And so I think there's something universal there.
They're basically bonded by trauma.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what's going on. And I see that constantly. Like I was a youth pastor for like 11 years. Mm. Like that happens like crazy. Like where kids are trying to hold each other up.
Yeah.
some successful, some not so successful.
So is it legitimately scary? Maybe not. I mean, look, let's be honest. It's hard to scare an audience, okay? It's 2017. Like, we're pretty hard to impress. We've seen it all on the internet, in other movies. We've got smartphones. So I would say actually legitimately scaring an audience takes incredible skill, which is why I'm so excited when it happens, which is why I'm such a huge It Follows defender, because not the whole movie, but certain scenes in there, like, gave me that feeling. And when I say scared, like, it's that feeling of, like, I don't want to be watching this right now. Like, I should probably leave. Like, that's where you want to get people in horror, and I can count on my fingers the amount of time that I've actually gotten there.
So I got that from It Follows,
mm-hmm.
where you're just kind of like, oh, this is laboriously anxiety-producing.
Exactly.
And it's like watching a Donald Duck cartoon and him, like, trying to do carpentry or something.
Like, that is a weird analogy.
Well, you're like, oh, this duck can't do carpentry. Doesn't he have fingers? So, all right, that's getting weird. But that's how I think.
Okay.
So, but it's this is frustrating almost to watch It Follows.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What I got from this movie was I felt like I got the chills several times watching this movie because mm-hmm. the concepts, it had some high scare concept.
Yep.
Versus stuff that's just like anxiety producing, because I can get anxiety over, like, oh, I forgot to pick up the dry cleaning. Like, that can produce anxiety. But this, like, this gave me, like, a deep, thoughtful chill on some of these. So it's a difference. I don't know how to describe that.
Yep. Agreed. So, yeah, I wouldn't say it's scary, but it's eerie. It will stick
it's
with you.
It's eerie. That's
and
exactly right.
It's eerie. Maybe that's enough. Mission accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
How about another question? Do horror movies like It have value?
Well, I don't generally value horror movies.
Okay. What don't you like about them?
They tend to not do any character development. They tend to be, well, there's different types. And there's, so that's a problem. Some of them are come out of a suspense thriller background. And I tend to like those more. Some of them are psychological. I mean, you get stuff that's even kind of like Twilight Zone-y
mm-hmm.
that would be considered horror. So it's a very hard genre.
Broad term.
Yeah. It's hard to nail down. But generally, you have like low amounts of character development, cheap scares, gore,
mm-hmm.
Lots of or evil ideas mm-hmm. that are like shocking evil ideas. So like, you know, well, we can make a horror movie about eating babies or some horror right? You
like
know what
perversely
I mean?
Evil.
Yeah, like yeah. perverse evil. So like, I'm like, I don't know if I want to expose myself to that.
Exactly.
But I think some of the better ones are they take reality and they tweak them.
Mm.
But I think. Generally, like this is, I think horror movies have been great this year. So isn't that funny that the movies have sucked, but the horror movies have been pretty good so far?
Last few years, it's been good, a good renaissance for horror. So I was a guest on a podcast a couple months ago called An Open Letter. Check out their podcast. And I was a guest on that, which was so exciting. It was an honor to be on there. And we talked about horror movies. It came up. And one of the people on the show said that they can't justify watching horror as a Christian because fear isn't something we're supposed to be dwelling on as Christians. The Bible says perfect love drives out fear. Fear isn't an emotion we should be reveling in because we're set free from it. And I agreed with them at the time and said that, truthfully, I like horror movies, but they're probably mostly guilty pleasures that I can't fully justify. But I keep going back and forth on it. What do you think about that idea of fear? Should we be dwelling on fear as Christians? Is that getting legalistic?
Well, I don't know if we dwell on fear or not, but I think... So this always goes back to like probably the first conversation you and I ever had, which is fear part of life?
Yeah.
And I would say, oh, absolutely it is.
Mm-hmm.
Are horrific things happening? Is there trauma for kids all over the place? Because like, that's what we see. That's the centrality of this movie. It's not Pennywise the Clown. It's it.
That's it.
Whatever it is for each kid,
yep.
right?
Yep.
And Pennywise just develops around whatever their trauma is. And so you know, my thoughts are, I think they're valuable. I forgot the question you just asked.
Well, is it, you know, it's the whole idea of like, you know, we're set free from fear, so we shouldn't be dwelling on fear.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. My brain got all...
It's okay. It's hot. It's toasty.
It's late.
In
here. I've been coached football right before this. So this fear idea is like, do we want to be feared, like deny that fear exists? Or is this movie going to be something... Because I think like the best horror movies, they call out what irrational fear is sometimes, or they legitimize things that are real.
Hmm.
So I look at Get Out and they're like, it does both.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Great movies.
So, I totally forgot that was this year. You're right. This has been a good year for horror.
So it is legitimizing, like, oh, wait, this is a real thing. Okay, and is this thing, you know, real thing? Is this worth what we've done here? No, probably not. Anyway, you don't want to get into that podcast right now.
No.
But I think the idea being, like, I think that they deal with our fears. Mm-hmm. So what I think to deny, like, that we have fear or that fear plays a major part in our life, to mm-hmm. me, would be to walk away from reality.
And it's sort of like that with, I mean, any sort of kind of conservative argument against movies could be, oh, do we want to watch that violence? Do we want to hear people swearing? Blah, blah, blah. I mean, that's the reason why a lot of people avoid the arts, right? But the main argument against that is, this is the reality we're living in. And yeah, we are redeemed, but we are also battling against sin every day, and that's reality. And I don't know. I mean, yeah, I would say that there is, you know, part of horror that you can't really justify, you know, like we were alluding to, the torture porn sort of genre, you know, just basically movies built around dismembering half-naked women. It's really hard to say, yep, that's valuable. Right.
It's just like cheap.
Right.
So it's like sex and violence, like just like elevated sex and violence.
Mm-hmm.
Without any concern for a point or getting to. So what I like about King is like it's funny because the very thing that you start out with is, oh, you know, conservative Christians think, you know, think that you'll be morally debased if you watch this, which is funny to me because he's actually dealing with highly moral ideas.
Absolutely.
Death and fear and what does it look like to love
and
right?
hope and love. Right.
So like this guy goes from lose like his cast, right? The guy that gets his arm broken, who's Is he a hypochondriac or no? His mom is.
His mom is, and
so he actually gets his arm broken, which is a real thing, right? And on his cast, some of this horrible, crappy person writes "loser" on there,
yeah.
And then he corrects it, "lover," and I think that like that spells out the film, right? So like through this horrible injury, like he learns to love because that's what he was doing. Like he basically was self-sacrificing, and that's how he got that injury.
Yeah.
So I think there's something to how he dealt with his fear, because the whole thing is like even those three doors in the movie, it's like scary, more scary, like, or something like that, or like absolutely mm-hmm. totally scary.
Mm-hmm.
And we always pick the door that's least scary. I think we do that as Christians, but the idea is like, will we face some of these fears? Mm-hmm. I think King is asking us to face some of these things through some of these films, which is a little bit scary.
You know, that theological question that people ask sometimes, like, you know, why did God put the tree in the garden of good and evil in the first place, right?
Okay.
And some people answer
that. The possibility of evil?
Yeah, why even create the possibility of evil? And some people answer that by saying that only in contrast to the darkness can love and grace and hope and joy be realized in all of its buty. Now, I don't know if I fully
dualistic
buy that
thinking.
Theological argument, but you know, some people even say like the black keys on a piano, you know, there's pianos mm-hmm. that have all white keys, and then you compare that to a full bodied piano and it's totally different. So right. I mean, maybe there's something to that. But I just would say that in the midst of a horror movie like It, love and redemption shine really bright in the midst of that darkness, and you walk away thinking about it.
So is the movie about a killer clown, or is it about a kids who deeply... I mean, it's about kids who've committed to deeply loving each other in the midst of fear.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like...
Right?
What's wrong with that morally?
Huh. Yeah, no kidding.
It's like there's this force that wants to destroy them, and they've united to say, even if it costs me everything, I'm going to fight that. Like, to me, wow, that should resonate with the gospel message. That shouldn't be. Why would we think that's, you know?
Yep.
It doesn't. And they're fighting. They're basically fighting.
They're fighting
evil.
Evil with love.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I read this Rolling Stone article. I don't know if you read it on Stephen King. It's fantastic. You should totally. It's like one of the best articles.
I will.
And they asked a question like, where's evil come from? Is it external or is it internal? And he said he wasn't sure. He said that it seems like sometimes it's and that he wrestles with that in all of his, this gets into your Greg Boyd conference, doesn't
it? Yeah, exactly.
So he's like, sometimes it seems external, but a lot of times it seems internal. I'm not always quite sure. And so he says, I think that we see characters that are wrestling with both of those things. So these kids are wrestling with this thing that seems like an external force in it, but they're also wrestling with evil that seems to have like come from their own, from people who created it.
Yes.
And then, and some of it is like their own phobias. So stuff like how they're made, you know, their makeup. So like, where did this come from? So you see these characters that are wrestling with those things. So it totally connects to your conference. I think it does.
I know. My favorite quote from you, Tim, that I've mentioned probably 1,000 times, is your quote where you were talking about, and this was when we first got coffee together way back in the day. You said something is offensive if it's not true. And I love it. And it really framed how I view offensiveness. And it's just like, I think that's exactly what we're getting at here. It's like, you can make a conservative case for avoiding all evil, but is it true? Is it true to life? And if we're going to be truthful about, you know, the powers at work in this world, which the Bible never shies away from, that there is real evil in this world and never shies away from showing it in its heroes, it's all over the pages, then we need to accurately represent that evil, right? Yeah. Pennywise the clown is a representation of real evil in this world. I think the worst thing you could do is make like a PG movie about a scary clown. I mean, like, right? I mean, it's sort of like those PG-13, you know, movies, violent movies where you shoot someone and there's no blood and they fall over. I mean, isn't that doing more damage than actually showing what violence does?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think of the character of the girl's dad who's like he's sexually abusing her. And he is constantly worried that someone is going to take her innocence, which is so funny because like he's the one that's actually taking.
Yeah, no kidding.
And I'm not like getting into all this purity culture crap. I'm not going to get into that. But I think the idea is like he locks her up.
Yeah.
And he says, you can't go into that big bad world. And then he creates this false world that like that is just like is terrifying. So so I see that as like, I think if we're not careful, like even our best attempts at trying to limit evil can become quite insidious, right?
Yes.
So that we would actually create these disgusting, distorted realities by trying to lock people away from the world.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that's like very, so like that lines up with like a form of abuse.
Mm-hmm.
So I see that we can, I know people are not going to like this comment, but I think we can do that where we're trying to constantly avoid evil. We create this bizarre false reality.
Yes.
Because evil exists, folks. Mm-hmm. You know, not that I want to embrace or that,
no.
that. I mean, I think we should all have a healthy fear. But I think that when we try to limit evil so much that we're like, well, it never impact any of my kids or something like that. I think that's so unreal. Living such unreality, it is offensive to me.
Beautiful. All right. Well, we're winding down here. What themes did you see at work? Were there any specific themes that jumped out at you?
I think that's like, I have a recovery mindset. So I think of the idea of that that isolation is the enemy of, the absolute enemy of us and our souls and who we are. And that if we become isolated and try to deal with all of our stuff on our own, that's when we get destroyed. So I see that theme throughout this. I also see a theme of community is the place where we have power and community where we are authentically, we're authentic and open and share our wounds is a place where evil is defeated. And so like, how are we not like picking up on this Christians? Right?
Yes.
Like, you know, I just don't get it.
I agree 1,000%. I'm also have been in through addiction recovery, and that's where the power is. That's the power. The worst thing you can do to if you are trying to conquer something, you know, an idol in your life or a sin pattern in your life, is to deal with it on your own. You will never be able to do it. But when you are gathered in a circle of people and able and feel safe to share anything, and feed off their encouragement, that is where the power is. Yeah. I mean, that's just, yeah.
Yeah, and then like most of those, it's so funny because like folks, if you've been in recovery stuff long enough, which, you know, I do recovery stuff, you begin to go like, oh, where did this come from? And it's almost always childhood trauma.
Absolutely.
And so I think like Stephen King is totally onto something and not just onto something, but I think he's definitely like jumped headfirst into reality.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the church sometimes can't handle that kind of stuff. And I would hope that we would be open to that. But I think like this whole that totally overlaps with the recovery for me too.
So I mentioned the biblical morality that keeps showing up in King's work, and one theme for me that comes up again and again is the idea of kids being the only people who can actually solve the problem. So a lot of times in King's writing, the adults just can't get it, they refuse to get it, and it's all up to the kids. And I think this is also something that's so biblical. Jesus said, unless you become like a little child, you can't enter the kingdom of heaven. Like the whole gospel is built around this concept that we have to actually become like little kids to follow Jesus. And, you know, the disciples are always trying to shoo the kids away, but Jesus loves the kids because kids are honest and they're vulnerable. They show their emotions. They don't try to box them up. They don't try to use religion to strap people down. They don't try to pretend everything's fine. And in it, we just see this all over the place, that the kids, they're able to endure so much more than I think the adults in the movie would be able to endure. You know, that girl's creepy dad, he would probably drop dead if he saw Pennywise. But these kids are able to go through this. And that just goes back to the heart of the gospel. The lowly, the weak, the powerless, those are the people who inherit the kingdom. I love it. I love it. All right, Tim, final thoughts and a letter grade.
Okay, so I give it an A-.
Okay.
I don't think it's a perfect film, but I kind of try to keep the A there, but I think it's worth seeing even in the theater. And maybe if you don't want to be afraid, don't go to it. But otherwise, I think it's a great film, and I don't like horror movies, and I thought this was definitely worth the watch. And see, I think horror movies you should see on the big screen.
Yes.
It's just one of
those
things.
Something so lost when you see it on streaming on your device.
It's really unfortunate. My guess is if this had come out in July, this thing would have been making even more money.
You think so?
Oh, well, I guess it's R, so maybe not.
Yeah.
But I think it was better than a lot of the summer movies.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I agree. I love this movie. I went in expecting just pretty much a straight-up genre film. I mean, that's kind of what the trailers alluded to. And I'm just so proud of Andy Muschietti that he took his time to tell a story, to get us into that sense of place, not just rushing off to the next cheap thrill, but truly setting something up that actually gets in our bones in a good way and a bad way. And so the movie's eerie, great performances. Bill Skarsgård, I'm a defender of his performance. I think it works all the way through. Are there flaws? I would say, I think you alluded to this before, Tim, that there are some kind of the standard horror tropes do show up.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a little bit of repetition in kind of, especially when Pennywise is trying to reach out to each kid individually, it kind of, you start to get the rhythm of like, oh, here we go again on some level, even though it is effective. But all in all, it's a great movie. I'm giving it a B+, but this is like the highest B+ I've given this year. I do think this is actually, I think, going to come out at number 2 on my top 10, which really surprised me. But I was looking at the list, and this is going to be number 2. Dunkirk is still taking the cake this year. But yeah, man, I think the second best movie I've seen all year. What more can I say? Go see it, unless you don't like horror, and there's nothing wrong with that. But yeah, it's a good movie.
Yeah, I think it is good. Worth seeing.
So here's the thing that was exciting that I was mentioning before. If you'll notice at the end of It, in the credits, it says It Chapter 1 in the end credits. And that immediately sent me on a Google search because, again, I hadn't read the book, hadn't seen the original movie, and that's when I discovered this is only half the story. There is another half coming, and they've already signed on all the original kids. They're all coming back, and now we get to actually have adults cast in their role, because the second half, which I've done, I've purposely avoided all spoilers, but what I know, the premise, is that we see them as adults facing the clown again. And that, to me, is exciting. And who are they going to cast in the adult roles, right? I mean, think about it.
Ryan Gosling.
Ooh, Ryan Gosling. Tom Hanks.
Well, they've got to be 40.
Christian Bale.
Which is exciting for me, because I'll be 40 when this comes out.
Yes.
I'm an old guy.
So I'm pumped. I'm pumped for the sequel. I really am. And I purposely am not finding anything else out. I want to see what happens as it unfolds
in real
time. Don't
be a sequel hater, okay? Because you did that with Guardians.
Well, But this is different. This isn't a sequel. This is a continuation. That, to me, is totally different.
Chapter 2.
You know, it's like Lord of the Rings, man. I watch that every year. I love a good, big story. But when you've already made one full, complete story, and then you go back to the well, that's where things can get dicey.
Okay.
But anyway. All right, man. Next month is October, my favorite month of the year. If you know me, you know that. And not just because it's my birthday month. I was an only child. But October is special, man. So many reasons. And I'm going to explain all those reasons on the next pod. So tune in for that. And you do also have to come back in October because we will be reviewing Blade Runner.
It's exciting.
Harrison Ford, Ryan Gosling. The trailer's out of the park. The director is the director of Arrival. It's got a great aesthetic. This dude.
Who is it?
Dennis Villeneuve.
I don't know anything. I haven't done.
He did Arrival. You saw Arrival.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great directing. I didn't love Arrival as much as everyone else, but I can agree that it was some of the best directing and aesthetics of the year. And not only that, this dude loves the original Blade Runner. It says it's his favorite movie of all time, and he painstakingly went about making this sequel with fear and trembling. And according to Ryan Gosling in an interview, you would have a scene in a script. This is Ryan Gosling interview. He basically said you'd have this little three sentence idea of a scene, and they would spend a week creating the set for that three sentences. That's how much this guy's obsessed with Blade Runner.
It's they fight and they created a big fight scene. So is it original one's Ridley Scott?
Ridley Scott, yeah. Okay. And I will be going back and watching the original.
I have to
before
watch the original again.
It.
I watched it a couple times, but you got
to
do it.
You have to. Yeah, because this is kind of a continuation of the story.
And then so. Dan was saying, so these are based on short stories.
Blade Runner?
Yeah, the same guy wrote Total Recall.
Oh, see, I didn't know that.
But he said they're so abstract that it's hard. That there's ideas within the stories that they're based on. Anyway, Dan is our resident literary expert.
Yes, Dan is rolling his eyes once more.
I've read the guy's name, but that's a quick Google away, I'm sure.
Yes.
But it'll be interesting to see the difference, and then maybe even compare to some of the original source, or maybe not. Who knows?
I can't wait.
Depending on what kind of time I got with all my kids.
Ditto. As always, please, please rate and review our podcast on iTunes. I know everyone says this to you. Please, why not have this podcast be the one where you actually do it?
Don't
this
click
is the
to
one.
The next podcast.
This
right
is the
now.
One. You could actually just spend 60 seconds. You got your phone, right? You're at work or you're at home and you're listening to it on your iPhone. Go to your iPhone. Go to the podcast app. You're going to search for Cinema Faith, and you are going to find us, and you're going to see review right there. You can. There's a little review tab.
I feel like we're taking the offering at church every time.
I know. This
we're
is terrible.
Like, the Lord's blessed you in so many ways.
That's what we're doing wrong.
And this is your chance to show us how much we've blessed you by blessing us. Does that sound a little creepy?
I love
a little
it.
Bit? You kind of like it?
What would Joel Osteen do? That's all I have to say.
I don't know. Our best podcast now.
Yes.
Something, I don't know.
So you just want to hit that 5-star rating, and you're going to leave a sentence. That's all it takes. You could say, John and Tim nail it every month. Always look forward to this one. You could. I'm just feeding you lines. Write this down. Go do it.
Christian buffoon. Whatever you want.
Yes, whatever you want.
We need you to say something.
To say one thing. Because, we don't make the rules, but Apple decided that the more ratings and reviews people have, the higher they show up in the search results, and other people will find the show. So please do that. Thank you very much. And don't forget to drop us a line. Our email address, as always, is podcast@cinemafaith.com. Easy to remember.
We're
do
open,
some research.
We're open to suggestions for movies to see, too, right?
Ooh, oh, absolutely.
We don't guarantee we're going to watch The Smurfs Chapter 9 or whatever you want. But we'll definitely, if you send us a suggestion, you're like, hey, you haven't done enough independent films. We'd be like, oh, you're right.
We would
and then
love
we would,
to hear
we
from
would
you.
Love to hear that and get some feedback.
Absolutely. All right, man. That's it. Tim, always great talking film with you. We will be back next month. Keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.